Getting ready, come look and see what I have found. A little way away from here while digging in the ground.
Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. It's nothing but a picture book they had before the war.
Daddy, Daddy, come and see. Oh, Daddy, come and look. There's four or five Melinda girls inside this picture book.
Oh, come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. There were lots of little girls like you before they had the war.
Daddy, Daddy, come and see. Oh, Daddy, hurry do. There's someone in the villages who's all grown up like you.
Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. That someone is a mother like you had before the war.
Daddy, Daddy, come and see. Such things I've never seen. Happy faces all alone, and all the ground is green.
Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. It's just the way it used to be before they had the war.
Daddy, Daddy, come and see and tell me if you can. Why can't it be the way it was before the war began?
Come away, Melinda. Come in and close the door. The answer lies in yesterday, before they had the war. You know, there are a dozen or more versions of that song by various artists, from Uriah Heep to Harry Belafonte. It's always sad, always powerful. This week, there's been an agreement that will lift sanctions against Iran, let that country trade with the rest of the world, and maybe defuse at least a little bit the possibility of war in the Middle East. So could it be that a war like the one in the song is a little bit less likely today? I hope it is. I'll never stop believing in peace. Never stop believing that the future of humanity depends on our learning to get along, learning to love each other, learning to respect each other, whatever we think about each other's beliefs. And that's why I'm here tonight and every Thursday night. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Don't forget to visit freedomslips.com and check out their other great shows. Maybe make a donation. Be sure to mention our show if you do. Don't forget to check out our archives at newdream.us, at newdream.us. And don't forget to love your neighbor, because peace starts small with you and me and our friends and neighbors. Thanks to my wife, Lorraine, for helping me sing the song tonight. I'm proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck and Lorraine. Tonight we welcome special guests, Larry Pinkney, Anthony Rayson, and M.K. Davis. And so tonight we are joining together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Duluth, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Chicago, Illinois, Benton, Mississippi, and wherever you are. My recommended list for tonight: films, Waco, Rules of Engagement, OKC, A Noble Lie, RFK Must Die. Another one, Wellstone, They Killed Him. I also recommend the Black Op Radio Archives on the JFK assassination. To learn about the RFK assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination, you can Google the name William Pepper. To learn about the Boston bombing and Sandy Hook, go to memoryholeblog.com. to be updated weekly on what's happening around the globe. Read Information Clearinghouse and Citizens for Legitimate Government. Also, False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio Thursdays with Jim Fetcher and Kevin Barrett. It just does not work to go to the New York Times and the Our Town Weekly Advertiser or National Public Radio or The Nation and Progressive Magazines or even Common Dreams or The Jon Stewart Show. I've tried that. You've tried that. It simply doesn't work. The truth about our lives and our world is out there, but you have to know where to look. And now sponsored by the good folks at Big Green Roman Catholic Cold War Blackboard Erasers, those Big Green creative, inquisitive mind erasers, another episode of All Quiet on the Middle School Front. A word from the front lines, the war for the mind. The American Academy of Letters and Colors, whole numbers, consonants, dot-to-dots, fractions, rhyming words, education, and high honors has just announced that middle school children should stop reading newspapers, magazines, and immediately stop watching TV news. It's a shame that you even started, to tell you the truth, says the press release document. We mean, what good is all this other stuff if you don't even know this, continues the official press release document. The Academy is offering extra credit in middle school and in liberal arts and education and history and meaning and stuff like that for any middle school American student who can say the alphabet backwards while walking a white line on the side of the road while touching the tip of their nose back and forth with their pointer fingers and then slapping the side of their heads with their open hands and saying, back and to the left, back and to the left, back and to the left. The American Academy of Letters and Colors, whole numbers, consonants, dot-to-dots, fractions, rhyming words, education, high honors, and stuff like that. Getting the hay down to where the sheep can get it. And as President Eisenhower warned us in his farewell address, Americans have the most to fear of anything in the whole wide world from the fat and stupid industrial complex. This conjunction of an immense stupid establishment and large arms is new in the American experience, said Eisenhower. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the fat and stupid industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Happily, I can say that total fat and stupid has thus far been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done in the field of leg raises, consonants, whole numbers, rhyming words, isometric exercises, exercise videos, gadgets, toys, and tools. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So, my fellow American citizens, down the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, the ever-growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the buffet table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certain agony of the battlefield. But we still have much to fear from the fat and stupid in their sweaty little hands and hearts who tread the tiles and waddle amid the walls of Walmart. And now a word from the American Good Guy Torture Black Site Network, Kojak, Barney Fife, Sheriff Andy, Matt Dillon, the Joe Friday Benevolent Association. When I tell you to wave or smile or hand over your identification, just do it. In the United States, military torturers and their political godfathers are granted amnesty automatically simply for being American, solely for belonging to the Good Guys Club. Largely because Americans say, it's okay, whatever they have to do to keep my family safe. It's not like this is El Salvador or Red China or nothing. The American Good Guy Black Site Torture Network, Kojak, Barney Fife, Sheriff Andy, Matt Dillon, Joe Friday, Benevolent Association. The last thing I want to do is to hurt you, but it's on the list.
Now, please join us as we look in on the new CBS reality TV show, One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, an American Mandela, an American Thomas Jefferson, an American prisoner. A prisoner, an American prisoner, recently looked out from his prison window, a high prison window in the middle of a big city, down on the little people and little cars below. Behind him on his coarse blanket on his bed, various newspapers and magazines were strewn about because he was allowed to have information coming in, just none going out. The dates on the papers and magazines were behind the times, but they did get there eventually. He was not allowed pencil or paper, but he was allowed to think, and as he did every day, he thought out the letter that he would send to everyone when he someday got that chance. He was for some reason sure that what he had to say would be news to those below, which it surely would be. I look out my window at kids on a playground with their mothers. Would these children know they live in a fascist society? Would their parents know they live in a fascist society? Is it possible to live in a fascist society without realizing it? Of course it's possible. When you talk about fascism, people instinctively talk about Hitler and Mussolini and brown shirts and walking goose step down the streets. That's fascism that's in your face. Of course, it doesn't have to be like that. That's not the defining feature. Fascism can be sexy. Fascism can look like American Idol or Monday Night Football, internet video games or whatever. It can be the things that distract you, the citizen, from what's actually going on. Fascism, in other words, can be a lot more attractive than they realize to people. What we have is invisible fascism. It's fascism that people can't really see, frankly, because most people don't have the conceptual tools to understand what's happened. Most people have to work. They've got families. They've got things to do. They're not out there to fight the machine. They're not out there to be heroes. They're just out there to live their lives. They don't want to have trouble. They haven't really studied this matter. They may feel in their bones that there's something wrong. Sure they do. But it's one thing to feel there's something wrong, and it's another to be able to put it all together and to conceptualize it and to see how it's wrong. So I see what has happened is that it's a fascism that you can feel, but you can't see it because you don't know how to see it. That's why I call it invisible. 9/11 plays a crucial part in allowing that, because what was necessary was to have a legal revolution within the United States, and that, of course, is what 9/11 has allowed. It's also allowed a fascist revolution. What else do we call it? It's gone under the radar as such. It seems Obama is another of the neocons, same as Bush, maybe same as them all, who believe in some guy called Leo Strauss more than the founding fathers. It's not what we're taught in sixth grade civics. It's not what we think of as America, but when we take a look at what is happening around us outside our windows up and down the freeways, we cruise along texting to each other about somebody said something about Susan somewhere. That might be what we have. We look out our window and ask, where is King? Where is Kennedy? Where's Wellstone? And of course, we know there's only us.
The American prisoner turned from the window as he heard familiar clatter in the hallway. The guard stuck his mail tray through the slot, and the prisoner exchanged greetings with the guard, took his tray to sit on his bed to eat. Join us next week on One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, an American Mandela, an American Thomas Jefferson, when we will see the American prisoner thinking about drones and dead children, rich people and poor people. Who really are the terrorists and who really are the freedom fighters? And stuff like that. Our first guest of the evening is M.K. Davis. M.K. Davis lives in Benton, Mississippi, and he informs us about Bigfoot, about the paranormal, about things that we probably need to think about but don't give it much thought. and we are proud each month to have MK talk to us, and Chuck will attempt to get MK on the phone right now.
Hello.
Well, hello, MK. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk, the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're on the air.
Okay. Hold on just a minute. Okay. I guess what I'm going to talk about a little bit tonight is a little adventure that I went on this past summer, this past June, rather, out to Death Valley. In California, Southern California. And I was looking for, we went to Joshua Tree National Forest, National Park first, and we're looking for some information on Bigfoot sightings that had been seen there and experienced there by campers. And my friend Don Monroe and I, spent a little time talking to people, and we talked to the rangers, and we kind of got the impression that there was nothing of any recent activity going on there. So we kind of switched to plan B, and we made our way back up through the desert, and that would be the Mojave, and toward Death Valley, which is in Southern California. And so on our way into Death Valley, we're on the southern end of the park. I spotted off in the distance up on the side of the mountain a little black spot. And I went up there. I told Don, I said, Don, I'm going to go up there and check that out. I got my camera and got a little good angle on it, and I can see that it was an opening in the side of the hill. And I went up there. And that's no easy task to go up there either. We're talking about 115 degrees. I guess if you cross things off on your bucket list, I guess I crossed doing Death Valley in the summer off my bucket list this year. But went up there, and it was indeed an ancient mine. I looked at it. I really was kind of unsure about, how old it was, but I began to find some evidence that it was pretty old. The patina on the rocks was pretty heavy, pretty thick. And what patina is the reaction of oxygen with the silicate materials on the rock and with the brilliant sunshine of Death Valley. It creates a false color. If you broke the rock open, you would see it was a different color. So it had a pretty thick and heavy patina on the rock. So I said, well, this has got to be old. I looked down kind of away from the mine a little bit, and there was an altar down there, an altar, a circle of rocks that someone had put into a circle and had put a little table inside the circle, and it was a little pyramid shaped rock on that table. And this thing was of an ancient origin. I mean, it was old. And I knew that this maybe it wasn't a mine, because I know that they're in that kind of environment. Sometimes they use something like that for storage. It could have been something used for storage, or it could have been, but whatever it was significant enough that they had created this little altar there, for it. And between the altar and back up at the mine itself, there was some tracks. And when I say tracks, the whole area was rocky, but occasionally here and there were little spits of clay, little tiny places where clay, was kind of sticking up. And there was a track. I don't know what the track was. It, to me, my first impression was it was looked like elephant, like an elephant's track, only smaller. But it was kind of, you know, superimposed straight down, you know, like a peg style. And you could see that the bottom of the foot was a pad because it was not straight across. You know, it did the wavy thing, you know, like flesh would do. So Don Monroe had some casting material that he brought up there and took a cast of it. And then we found another track on another spit of clay. Unlike the first one completely, it had three toes. And, well, I took it to be a toe, but I'm not, you know, beyond to thinking it could be a handprint because the toes were long like a finger. And I'd always heard that Death Valley was mysterious, but I mean, this was a real introduction to mystery here. And later on, when we made our way up to one of the visitor centers, there was a man working in there. It took us on a guided tour through one of these old home places that were there in Death Valley, and it's called Scotty's Castle. And this man was born and raised in that area, in the Furnace Creek area of Death Valley. And he took us through all the history of everything there. And then at the end, he said something that was very curious. He says, there's some people who say that the descendants of Lemuria came into Death Valley. And I was caught a little bit surprised by that. And I looked up Lemuria, and Lemuria was like considered to be the like the Garden of Eden, that the origins of man originally came from Lemuria, according to the Lemurian texts. I just kept looking into it because I wanted to see, you know, why he said that, and if possible, you know, did that altar have anything to do with it because it was of ancient origins. So I looked up a book by a man, like James Churchward, who had translated some Indian tablets from India that described the continent of Lemuria. And he gave a whole list of symbols that were from Lemuria. And according to Churchward, the round circle with the dot in the middle is a symbol of the deity of Lemuria, or Mu. And they had like a monotheistic religion where they only had one god, and that god was called the Almighty, or the Infinite One, that created everything. And that symbol, such as that the round ring of rocks with the point in the middle, was a Lemurian symbol. So I was kind of, you know, I felt kind of good about it, but you know, that I had at least gotten some information on it. But maybe that's the reason why he thought, or some people thought, that the descendants of Mu had come into Death Valley. But I looked up some Paiute legends about Death Valley, and they said that a race of people had come in there back in ancient times when there was water in the valleys. And they had come in boats, and they had these, they dug into the mountains and made their home underground, and that they were called the Havsimabs. And so they were, they would see Havsimabs occasionally, you know, even, you know, 1,000 years later. They would come out of there, and they'd have animals with them that were, he said, were white. But the Indians called them animals. They did not know what kind of animal they were. They weren't native animals. The animals that they had brought with them, allegedly. So that goes back to, a lot of times, you know, we don't really know positively our ancient history, our distant past. It's foggy. And I was able to take Churchward's book of symbols and actually translate some old Indian petroglyphs. You know, and I look at the petroglyphs, and they were the symbols. I looked in the book, and a lot of them were identical. So I knew what if they had been or had any connections with Mu, maybe perhaps, you know, it was possible to interpret those petroglyphs. And so some of them, if Churchward is correct, I was able to translate. And one of them is a standing deer figure standing on two legs. And that stands for the very first man. It stands for first man. And it's a symbol called Ke, K-E-E. And I said, well, you know, for how many years have people been looking at these petroglyphs? And they considered them to be rather infantile in their creation. But in reality, that they have rather deep meaning. So evidently, this little series of petroglyphs that these Indians had made, we're talking about the creation of man. And he had a symbol of, what else did it have? It had a symbol of the deity, a round circle with a dot in the middle. And then on the outside of that circle was a series of rays. Well, the sun's rays also represent the deity. So in the middle, they had a coil. You know, like you see so familiarly on the petroglyphs. And Churchward said if that coil ends up to the right, that means you're going. And if it ends up to the left, that means you're coming. So that little petroglyph meant that the one true God was coming. And the first man was standing beside it, the deer that was standing, you know, upright. I got a little wave of pleasure over that because the Indians were grown men. They weren't little kindergartners. You know, they were telling their story. You know, and some of that may be involving, you know, the distant past and people we know little or nothing about. You know, so it was a real, real educational, eventful trek through Death Valley. The temperature got up to 120 degrees on our second day there. So I really don't recommend that. I came home and stayed sick for a week and a half. But, you know, sometimes things were just meant to be. And we stumble across this ancient mine, you know, just by happenstance.
Fascinating. And I'll tell more about Death Valley.
I can't hardly hear you, but I thank you and I appreciate it.
Join us now as we join In Progress, the next episode of Nebraska Inc., Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland. The locals know her as Babs. Her shop is on Main Street between the barber shop and the cafe, with a picture of a floundering big plane atop the front door. She got off course, or she's hiding out, waiting for her chance to do what she was asked to do so long ago by FDR.
Or maybe there was no spy mission for FDR, just a desire to fly around the world. She doesn't seem to care anymore. She just wants to be free to live out her days in Nebraska doing what she loves, talking about the Cornhuskers and making tattoos. Navigator Fred Noonan runs the front desk at the little tattoo shop. He's got his shirt all up, his feet all up on the desk, his tongue sticking out, working on a full stomach tattoo of the Marshall Islands. "Hey, Fred," Amelia shouts from the back room. He knows what she's going to say, so he revs the motor high. Amelia's going to ask again what they were doing out in the Pacific and what FDR asked them to do. "Hey, Fred!" And then she's going to ask how they crashed, how they survived, and how they got back. "Fred!" And was it all a dream? And what they're doing in Nebraska? Amelia has a bobblehead alien doll named Roswell on her desk. She's got a black Bilderberg birthday balloon stuck to the ceiling, signed by Prescott Bush. There's black and white photos of the JFK, RFK, and MLK shootings on her wall, all from angles and bandages that have never appeared elsewhere. On her desk is a stack of letters from the passengers from the planes of September 11, 2001 that she hasn't had time to answer. One from Timothy McVeigh, postmarked with a tropical stamp. There's a CD in the machine, the director's cut of the Sandy Hook shooting. She watched it last night, stayed up too late. Now she's paying for it. Her niece is visiting for a few days this summer. Amelia Rose Earhart. She just completed a flight around the world that covered Auntie Amelia's same flight, ending up in Nebraska. The niece wants to just hang out and maybe learn the art of tattooing and get a Cornhuskers journey and eat corn with her bare hands while sitting on the railroad tracks and running her bare toes through the hard red rocks. And she says she is waiting for someone. Amelia walks up front, tells Fred she's going to the store for cigarettes, and all the while she's just staring up at the sky, tripping a few times, then bending down to pluck a yellow tulip from somebody's prim front yard garden and sticking it behind her ear. "Where are you?" she whispers with wide, wet eyes just before she bumps into the produce manager from Too Much Food, bending her tulip. He gives her a black tulip as she hands him the yellow tulip without quite knowing why. She goes in to open her mailbox with her key and pulls out a manila envelope marked with a 1937 stamp marked postmarked Manila, forwarded to the Bangkok Bar in East Minneapolis and then on to Nebraska. There's someone else in the post office pulling something out of his box. Amelia asks the young man, "What did you get?" He turns to her and says, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 to pick up the garbage." She runs her long purple fingernail under the flap, cuts herself, licks her finger, swallows the blood, pulls out a black and white 8x10 glossy photograph of she and Fred standing on the beach on some island, their arms around the shoulders of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Joe DiMaggio, Al Capp, and Al Capone. And now, that photograph, copies of that photograph have turned up in the teacher's lounge of St. Regis Jesuit High School in Denver, as well as the condiment table of the State Road Department Paint Crew Coffee Corner on Harney Street in Omaha, Nebraska, and in the dining car of the Amtrak California Zephyr at midnight. Into that dark dining car, screeching through Del Mar, empty but for the tired cook smoking at the bar, comes a tall man in a tweed suit, wearing a Stetson with a Miami Dolphin sticker, steel-toed boots marked Made in Havana, and carrying a briefcase handcuffed to his arm. He sits down in the back booth, stares out the window, opens the briefcase with a key he draws so slowly out of his nose. He lays the briefcase flat on the table, reverently draws out the 8x10 black and white glossy photograph of Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, Joe DiMaggio, Al Capone, Al Capp, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting in a window booth at Alice's restaurant. The thin man in the Stetson autographs the photograph with a purple magic marker, leaves the purple magic marker resting on the 8x10 glossy photograph, tips his cap to the smoking cook and exits the dining car. The tired cook smoking at the bar slumps over, picks up the 8x10 glossy photograph as the purple magic marker rolls to the floor. He opens a window, slides the photograph out, and it is caught by the wind and then by a biker sitting by the tracks in the woods on his black 1946 Indian Chief cycle. The passenger on the bike wears a black leather jacket with Oswald stitched on the back. They take off into the woods, 1/2 mile exactly, hand the 8x10 glossy photograph to a 10 3/4 foot jet black Bigfoot named Bubba Brad, just as a craft hovering above the valley turns on its landing lights. Alan, the alien, The driver of the craft, marked Malaysian 370, shines the light on Bubba Brad, and a 10 3/4 foot Bigfoot glides up the beam of light, as if on an escalator. As he enters the shuttle bus, he hands the 8x10 glossy photograph to a man wearing a plastic sheriff's badge that says secret agent. The man is from East Grand Forks. He is, of course, Zach Black, an extra in the movie The French Connection, who's done other things since then. Bubba Brad the Bigfoot whispers to Zach Black, "Beware the Ebola bunny," which causes Zach Black to wonder about the overall sincerity of Bubba Brad the Bigfoot, but he has a job to do, and so Zach Black puts the glossy photograph under a class 51 flashy thing electron microscope and sees the markings embedded in the photo that say Ukraine, Israel, Syria, Gaza, Libya, Egypt, Iran, ISIS, ISIL, buried at sea, Jessica Lynch, Pat Tillman, torture photos at Guantanamo. And Black Ops rendition cruises in a 61 gray Studebaker from the A&W on North Street in East Dubuque to the Moose Lodge in Davenport. He sees something more in the embedded microchip thing photo part, something about Amelia's niece, something about her not being who she says she is, something about her being a former cheerleader for the Iowa Hawkeyes, and oh my. Can this be? He can also see that she has a tattoo on the small of her back. A monarch butterfly, a honeybee, and a decapitated Hawkeye mascot with a Cheshire Cat smile. And below that it says in ancient Mayan script, MH17, David Shaler, Charlie Sheen, CIA Obama, Wile E. Coyote, beep, beep, and a number, 8765309. And Black looks up and asks, though nobody is in the room, "Waiting for who?" "It's Amelia Rose, the niece, waiting for who?" And the thought comes into Black's head from somewhere, somehow, to every man his little cross till he dies and is forgotten. And then the thought is gone, and he returns to his task. This niece here, waiting for who? Waiting for, I don't know. Black hears a voice in the dark room. He turns around and says, "Who's there?" Nobody answers. He says louder, "Who is there?" Black gets a piercing pain in his temple, and an image is projected into his brain, and it is the Ebola bunny. And then a deep foreigner voice, "Stay thirsty, my friends." And then the Ebola bunny turns into the face of Bill Hicks, and Zach Black hears Hicks speak. "I was over in Australia. They celebrate Easter the exact same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. I wonder why we're effed up as a race. Anybody got any idea? You know, I've read the Bible. I can't find the word bunny or chocolate anywhere in the fucking book. Where did they come up with this stuff? Why not goldfish left Lincoln Logs in your sock drawer? As long as you're making crap up, you know, go hog wild. At least the goldfish with a Lincoln Log on its back going across your carpet has some miraculous connotations. Mommy, I woke up today. There was a Lincoln Log in my sock drawer. That's the story of Jesus." And then, more silence. And then a door squeaking open, squeaking closed. as something rolls slowly, unevenly, as a lopsided bowling ball across the floor of the darkened room. It bumps against Black's shoe. He leans down, squats, looks close. Black gasps loudly, stands quickly to get away from the head of Officer Obi. And somewhere a radio plays. The door of a red VW microbus is open. The engine is smoking but running. The red VW microbus is smacked into a tree. Blood everywhere. Implements of destruction scattered everywhere. Inside bodies above and around the red VW microbus. And all those inside the red VW microbus. Timothy McVeigh, Barbara Olson, George W. Bush, Crystal Campbell, Paul McCartney, Buddy Holly, George H.W. Bush, Mrs. Calabash, Barbara Bush, John Stewart, Rachel Maddow, Todd Beamer, Nancy Lanza, Jack Ruby, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Carl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, Bart Simpson, the Coen Brothers, Stanley Kubrick, Walt Disney, John Dulles, Buzz Aldrin, Tom Hanks are dead, all dead, and sitting on top of the VW microbus, on the tip top of the bus, on the very top of the VW microbus with etchings like cave drawings in the dust of the top of the VW microbus, like crop circles, like footprints, like butt crop circles, way up there on the roof, wearing bell-bottom jeans, no shoes, flower shirt sporting San Francisco Giants athletic team jerseys and wearing flowers in their hair and strumming air guitars, playing air flutes, harmonicas, a whole air instrument orchestra, but no bassoons, are Dawn Hochsprung, Timothy McVeigh, Muhammad Atta, Thane Eugene Caesar, Barbara Olson, Gene Rosen, and Adam Lanza. Secret agent Zach Black Strange stands still with the head of Officer Obi still touching his toe. He strains all the limits and boundaries of credulity and space and time to hear the radio in the red VW microbus. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Mystery, deceit, tattoos, tattered tulips, manila envelopes, Quebec Red, Harney Street, purple magic markers, and Del Mar landing lights, East Grand Forks, ISIS, ISIL, A&W, Hawkeyes, Beep Beep, Fred and Amelia, the Ebola Bunny, Father Rapers, Air Orchestra, crop butt circles. It's all there, waiting for you in the next episode of Nebraska Inc. Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland. Our next guest of the evening is Anthony Rayson. Anthony Rayson comes to us each month from Chicago. Anthony is a publisher, a writer. He publishes designs, and he communicates with prisoners, and he gets their writings, and he publishes those writings. He does an immense service, and we're proud to have Anthony with us each month, and Chuck will be getting Anthony on the line right about now.
Hello.
Hello, Anthony. You're live on the New American Dream Radio Show. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. We had a very productive morning, me and three other members of the No Ileana for Us group addressed the Will County Board and told them all kinds of reasons why they should put resolutions together against not just the Ileana Tollway, but also the Piatone Airport. In the last couple of months, we got every township and village along the 50-mile corridor to pass resolutions against it, as well as other groups like the Will County Farm Bureau and Soil and Water Conservation Group. All these quasi-political groups that are, you know, have a stake in this. So that was very good. But I'd like to read a few letters from prisoners that sort of explain why it's so important that we do this educational Zine Distro Forum. Here's a letter from a fellow named John Bebko at Collins Correctional, P.O. Box 340, Collins, New York, 14034. He says, "Howdy, folks. I really like the random zines you sent. One was a perfect share for a Yemeni inmate who I've repeatedly heard trying to explain the situation in his country as being primarily a reaction to imperialism in one of the poorest countries on earth, and always talks about how growing up no one took too much notice of different religious affiliations, aside from some people worship Friday or Saturday or Sunday. How the main conflict when he was growing up was between his uncles with Soviet loyalties and his uncles with Western loyalties. All this is usually way outside the scope of experience of people he's trying to explain it to who have been fed an image of eternal religious violence. Words on paper, somewhat sadly, make a difference for him in backing up what he's laying down. Anyway, information outside the dominant narrative is appreciated and helpful in here. Thank you for keeping it out there. I picked the scattering based on my own varied interests, trying to think also of people I can share them with. Make any substitutions you like. I'll try to include at least enough posted to cover me, and I hope someone else. Thanks again." Then he lists about 20 zines that he wants. Here's a letter from a fellow named Rashim Grover, number 0106026. He's at Hutchison Correctional Facility, P.O. Box 1568 in Hutchinson, Kansas, 67504. "Mr. Anthony Rayson, thank you very much for taking the time to send me the three zines I was asking for, Power of the Pen, The Black Panther Legacy, and What Prisoners Should Know About Social Security. Unfortunately, the only zine I was allowed to have was What Prisoners Should Know About Social Security. I would like to know if you would send me a few more zines. I would like Write or Die Behind the Zines with Anthony Rayson, Michelle Alexander and Randall Robinson Interviewed, Mass Incarceration of Black America, Inside Books Project Resource Guide, Inmate Outmate Positive Relations, and WPP Prisoner Support Directory. Hopefully I'll be allowed to have them all. Thank you again for taking the time to get true information into the hearts and minds of the people. Stay true, stay strong, keep doing what you've been doing. I look up to you because of what you do. You're a leader and you are making a difference. We don't have many people like that left. Thank you again." And he sent me the rejection notices, which is also ridiculous. Okay, here's one from Neville Franklin, 0135453 at Central Prison, MSC 4285 in Raleigh, North Carolina, 27699. "Dear sir, I just got a package of your zines a while ago, and I sure do want to thank you for them. The names of the zine is The Red Heart Warrior, Malcolm X Revolutionary, The Ballad or the Bullet, and Blacks on John Brown. Also got the two pieces of paper, also which I thank you also for it. It's about poetry from behind the walls, and a Second Chance newsletter. Sir, I really enjoyed this one also very, very much, and thank you for all of the package. If you would please send me some more of your nice zines, sir, because I really, really enjoyed myself, and I read them over and over until I know each and every one of these zines by heart. Sir, could you please send me more zines on Malcolm X plus the Red Heart Warrior, and do you have any zines on the Trail of Tears? If so, please send them to me. Also, do you have any zines on poems about prison or any other said kind, sir? Whatever zines you send me, I'll very much be thankful for them, sir. And I always will keep them and read them over and over, plus let other brothers read them also. I gave your address to others and asked them to order zines from you, and they said they would. So I never will forget you, sir, as long as I live, and you are in my prayers, hearts, thoughts, day and night, and always will be, sir. You know, I want you to know there are not too many people who will help us prisoners out because most of them turn their backs on us and walk away from us because we're in prison. I know some of us can't help but be in here, sir. So like I said, I surely do thank you for your kindness, plus sharing and caring for me and other prisoners also. Hope to hear from you soon. Here's one from a Native prisoner, Jeff Lafferty, BQ5480. He's at 301 Morea, M-O-R-E-A Road, Frackville, Pennsylvania, 17932. He wrote this on a paper towel. Mr. Rayson, sir, I'm in the RHU at SC Mahoney, Noy, with William Kramer. He's an anarchist, but when he got your catalog, he is a supporter of your magazine. He was telling all of us to get in touch with you for your catalog, but now they put him in a hard cell with only a mattress, no pillow, no sheets, no nothing, not even a toilet paper. It's a shame and degrading as a man to be put it like that. It's like he's a political prisoner or a terrorist. He needs help, and I don't know anything to help him, but he needs help. He's a proud man of who he is. I have no help for him. I myself have been down for 26 years, and my people have passed on. But please see what you can do for your brother. It's sickening what goes on back there. No one really knows much of anything about it. Here's one from a Mr. Quentin Coleman, H2736, IA-25, 10745, Route 18, Albion, Pennsylvania, 16475. Anthony Rayson, hello, bro. I'm writing you to give you good cheers on your writing of Anarchism, the Advanced Studies of Giving a Damn. Me and the guys here that I read it liked it very much. I've been reading a lot of your zines to the guys here to open up their eyes and to get them to take a stand against their oppressor. But they're so brainwashed and too fearful to make a stand. These COs and prison workers do what they want to these guys, and they let them get away with it. I don't know what to do anymore. I can't do it by myself. What should I do? I'm fighting right now to send money out to you, but they're telling me that it's against the rules. I read the rule book, and I didn't see nothing in there about it. They don't sell stamps. I don't have family doing anything for me. My own mother don't even write me or send me anything.
No, we're out of time, but thank you so much.
All right. Give you a little taste of what's going on in there. All right, well, thank you. I'll talk to you next month. Take care. Bye-bye.
There once was a man who worked at a defense plant making gunpowder, then bullets, then he made bombs. He came to work each day, each week, each year, and over time, he eventually made bigger and better bullets and bombs. And then one day, he hit his head, bonk. He was not looking, and he conked his forehead right into a heavy, solid metal piece on the frozen children's playground as he walked to work. He felt different, as if something in his head had been knocked loose or knocked into place.
The swinging mill bell changed its rate to tolling like the count of fate. And though at that the tardy ran, one failed to make the closing gate. There was a law of God or man that on the one who came too late, the gate for half an hour be locked, his time be lost, his pittance docked. He stood rebuked and unemployed. The straining mill began to shake. The mill, though many, many eyed, had eyes inscrutably opaque, so that he couldn't look inside to see if some forlorn machine was standing idle for his sake. He couldn't hope his heart would break. And yet, he thought he saw the scene. The air was full of dust and wool. 1,000 yarns were under pull, but pull so slow with such a twist. All day from spool to lesser spool, it seldom overtaxed their strength. They safely grew in slender length, and if one broke by any chance, the spinner saw it at a glance. The spinner still was there to spin. That's where the human still came in. Her deft hand showed with finger rings among the harp-like spread of strings. She caught the pieces end to end, and with a touch that never missed, not so much tied as made them blend. Man's ingenuity was good. He saw it plainly where he stood, yet found it easy to resist. There once was a man who worked at the defense plant making bullets. Then he made bombs. He came to work each day, each week, each year, and over time he eventually made bigger and better bullets and bombs. And then one day he hit his head. Bonk. He was not looking, and he conked his forehead right into a heavy, solid metal piece on the frozen children's playground as he walked to work. He felt different, as if something in his head had been knocked loose or knocked into place.
He knew another place, a wood, and in it tall as trees were cliffs. And if he stood on one of these, 'twould be among the tops of trees, their upper branches round him wreathing, their breathing mingled with his breathing. If he stood, enough of ifs. He knew a path that wanted walking. He knew a spring that wanted drinking, a thought that wanted further thinking, a love that wanted re-renewing. Nor was this just a way of talking to save him the expense of doing. With him, it boded action, deed. The factory was very fine. He wished it all the modern speed, yet after all, 'twas not divine. That is to say, 'twas not a church. He never would assume that he'd be any institution's need, but he said then and still would say, if there should ever come a day when industry seemed like to die because he left it in the lurch, or even merely seemed to pine for want of his approval, why, come get him. They knew where to search. Well, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Polachek with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. U.S. law enforcement officials announced another terror arrest on Monday after arming a mentally ill man and then charging him with having guns. ABC's News quoted a senior federal official briefed on the arrest as saying, "This is a very bad person, arrested before he could do very bad things." But in a sting reminiscent of so many others conducted by the FBI since 9/11, Alexander Chicola, 23, a.k.a. Ali al-Amriki, was apparently a mentally ill man who was doing nothing more than ranting about violent jihad and talking about launching attacks until he met an FBI informant. At that point, he started making shopping lists for weapons.
From Citizens for a Legitimate Government, FBI Director James Comey said that law enforcement officials stopped an undisclosed number of plots to kill people in the United States over the 4th of July holiday. The plots were linked to the Islamic State terror group who wanted to carry out attacks which would have caused mayhem across the country, but they were thwarted by federal agents who have ramped up security efforts in recent months to arrest Islamic State sympathizers across the country. Of course they were.
ExxonMobil, the world's biggest oil company, knew as early as 1981 of global warming, 7 years before it became a public issue, according to a newly discovered email from one of the firm's own scientists. Despite this, the firm spent millions over the next 27 years to promote climate denial. Exxon's public position was marked by continued refusal to acknowledge the dangers of global warming, even in response to appeals from the Rockefellers, its founding family, and its continuous financial support for climate denial. Over the years, Exxon spent more than $30 million on think tanks and researchers that promoted climate denial, according to Greenpeace.
Former fake president George W. Bush charged $100,000 to speak at a charity fundraiser for U.S. military veterans severely wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. And former First Lady Laura Bush collected $50,000 to appear a year earlier. Officials of Texas-based Helping a Hero charity confirmed to ABC News. The former president was also provided with a private jet to travel to Houston at a cost of $20,000, the officials said.
Today, Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush uttered a phrase that may not go over too well with the constituency he seeks to reach. During an interview that was live-streamed on the app Periscope, Bush told New Hampshire's The Union Leader that to grow the economy, people should work longer hours.
Leaked footage obtained from a staffer of U.S. Senator John McCain shows the making of an ISIL execution video similar to the videos portraying the beheading of James Foley and other victims. In the 3.5-minute video, ISIL executioner Jihadi John can be seen standing in front of a green screen. Beside a kneeling hostage wearing an orange jumpsuit and a green screen hood in a fully equipped studio in the presence of a production crew. The leaked source website recently reported. The desert-style set and wind machine effects share similarities to the beheading videos ISIL released of Stephen Sotloff, David Haynes, and Alan Henning.
The Oklahoma Republican Party on Tuesday removed a Facebook post that compared people who received food stamps to wild animals after it set off a social media storm. Titled A Lesson in Irony, the post from Monday night says the U.S. government is proud that its food stamp program, known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, this year reached 46 million people. Meanwhile, the National Park Service, administered by the U.S. Department of the Interior, asks us, please do not feed the animals. Their stated reason for the policy is because the animals will grow dependent on handouts and will not learn to take care of themselves.
A draconian austerity bill designed to pave the way for a new bailout of Greece has been passed in the Athens parliament against the backdrop of deep splits in the ruling Syriza party and the most serious violence on the city's streets in months. Tear gas filled the air outside the parliament as the debate took place, with riot police clashing with anarchists, and demonstrations against the bailout deal were joined by members of Syriza's own base. Greece's prime minister and Syriza's leader, Alexis Tsipras, has been under pressure from other Eurozone states to ensure that the raft of tax rises and spending cuts was passed. That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember that you can start the revolution today by making direct eye contact with any policeman.
Our next guest of the evening is Larry Pinkney. Chuck will be getting Larry on the phone right away. Larry comes to us each month from Minneapolis. Larry is a former member of the Black Panther Party. He's a former political prisoner. He is now a writer, radio host, activist. And again, he comes to us each month from Minneapolis.
Hello, this is Larry Pinkney.
Well, hello, Larry. It's Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Well, thank you both, Chuck and Mike. I deeply appreciate it. Today being, Thursday the 16th of July, 2015. First, let me begin by thanking you, everyone who makes this show possible, and most importantly, the audience that's listening. I want to share an experience today. Before I share this experience, and it was today, the 16th of July, before I share the experience, I want to go back to some of the things that I've been saying, and I always encourage people, I say each one reach one, each one teach one, and some people understandably might say, yeah, right, that sounds good, but how can we do that, okay? Having said that, we can do that. I repeat, we can do that. Today, I happen to be at a store picking up an item, and the cash register attendant or the cashier or whatever the proper term would be, happened to notice that I had a button on the hat that I was wearing. The button was a symbol of the Black Panther on white. In other words, it was just a button with just that, a symbol of the Black Panther with a white background. Anyway, I was just about to walk away, and the cashier said to me, "Excuse me, were you a Black Panther?" I went, And I noticed his words. He said, "Were you a Black Panther?" And I looked at him, rather stunned, but pleased, and said, yes, I was. In fact, I was one of the original members of the party. And he said, "Wow, could we talk about this a little bit?" Because it was no customer behind me. So we talked a bit. We talked about the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, which this young man knew all about. I say young man, he was in his mid to late 20s, 25 or older. And we talked. And we talked about the politics, the struggle, the people struggle of today, and what we need to be doing and where we should be going, and et cetera, et cetera. The point being that I'm not joking or jiving, as we would say back in the day. I'm not joking about when I say each one reach one, each one teach one. This is real. Whether we're in the supermarket, whether we're on the streets, just happen to be mailing a letter or whatever we're doing, you know, we need to stop and take time, especially with those of our sisters and brothers who show interest, wanting to know that they're not alone. Now, this young man clearly had an understanding, historical understanding, of the struggle that's going on, has gone on, I should say, and continues to go on today. And, you know, I share this because I want folks to know that sometimes we underestimate each other. We forget that when I say each one reach one, each one teach one, each one reach one, that's real. That's really what it comes down to, is all of us really reaching out to each other. And I, at this moment in time, am elated by the experience that I had today, because it once again reinforced what I have been saying for so many years, that we have to communicate with each other. Oh, yes, and by the way, the young man happened to be a white American. Duh. So that really matters? Well, you know what? What matters is, do we communicate with each other? With. I didn't say to each other. I said with each other. So I want us all to understand that even as we watch the insanity of our so-called leaders, who are in fact not our leaders at all, they are misleaders, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they are misleaders. You know, we know that they do not represent our interests. They represent the interests of trying to stay in the positions of, quote, power, unquote, that they are in. As we said back in the day in the original Black Panther Party, the original Black Panther Party, please folks, not the so-called new Black Panther Party. As we said back in the day in the original Black Panther Party, all power to the people. You see, because it's ultimately what it comes down to. And let's segue very quickly to Greece. You see how the EU, the so-called European Union, and the IMF, you see how they ignored the will of the overwhelming majority of people in Greece? They not only ignored it, but they're trying to make an example of the people in Greece. How dare you stand up to us? How dare you? We are the ones. We're not elected. Who cares? We're not elected. We are the ones, the banksters, the corporations. They are the ones. We, when I say we now, I'm putting myself in their position. We are the ones who will determine whether you live or die. I am saying to you, be you black, white, brown, red, or yellow, that is not acceptable. That is not acceptable. We, the people, everyday ordinary people. If it's one thing I like about both the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, it's that phrase called, we, the people. And it's about time, as a matter of fact, it's past time, that we take it back to our ideals. Now, don't confuse ideals, that's I-D-E-A-L-S, with what has actually been practiced. Ideals is one thing. Practice is quite another. Let's go back to our ideals. As the poem, Let America Be America Again, all right, by Langston Hughes said, let America be America again. Again. Let it be America again. This means work. The corporations, the government, which is nothing really more than a big corporation, from Barack Obama to his Democrat and Republican minions, on down. Okay? It's a criminal enterprise. Now, we understand that, but don't put up your hands in despair. Understand that ultimately the power rests with the people. And what do I mean by the word power? I mean the destinies. Our own destinies must rest with we, everyday, ordinary, black, white, brown, red, and yellow people. Everyday, ordinary, struggling people. We are the ones. Do not be fooled by the smoke and mirrors of the vomit stream corporate media. That's right, the vomit stream corporate media. Turn it off. Unplug from that. Please, folks, unplug from that. And plug into yourselves first and foremost, and then plug in to everyday, ordinary people, your neighbors, people that you meet on the street. Where are you going at your jobs? That's what we meant back in the day in the original Black Panther Party when we said all power to the people. Do not be fooled. Do not be bamboozled, as Brother Malcolm X said. Do not be fooled or bamboozled by the constant barrage of vomit and distraction and diversion and distortion that we get from the corporate stream media, from the government, and really they're one in the same. We have to come together. We have to understand in our towns, in our local communities, in our cities, in our states, we must understand that this is about all power to the people, everyday, ordinary, struggling people, not chumps and punks. And when I say punks, I'm not talking about it sexually. I'm talking about it in terms of being used, manipulated, had, abused, all right? Let's not be chumped. Let's not be chumped out. And that's what the corporate stream media is all about. And by the way, for those of you who might think that the Obamatron struck some kind of wonderful deal with the sovereign nation of Iran. I will remind you that Barack Obama was and continues to be drone man. He has killed hundreds of thousands of people in North Africa, East Africa, Afghanistan, Pakistan. It's an endless list that won't be missed, as Gil Scott Heron would say. He is not a peacemaker. It's just a prelude to further his agenda, or the agenda of both the Democrats and Republicans, and I call them Republicrats. But you know what? The power lies with whom? It lies within each and every one of us, my sisters and brothers, my brothers and sisters, each and every one of us. So let us understand that right here in this country, the United States of America, we have a task at hand. And that task is very simple. It's not complicated. I repeat, it is not complicated. It is a task where we must overcome our differences. Of course we will have differences. We should have differences. If we don't, somebody's lying. But we will overcome those differences for the benefit of our common good. For the benefit of our common good. And neither the Democrats or the Republicans are interested in our common good. We the people. So I'm going to stop right now and just simply say thank you so very, very much. All power to the people. I hope you stay strong and vigilant in the struggle.
Thank you so much, Larry.
And now, a message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph. From a Fred F. in Bedrock, New Jersey. Lately, I find that my frustration with the level of idiocy on the part of this planet I call home is so great that writing has become nearly impossible. A recent article by Andrew Vilcek titled "In the USA I Cannot Write" gave me comfort. I'm not alone. Here in the belly of the beast, among the zombie, fascist, gun-toting, flag-waving hordes of fellow Americans, I spend my days in fearless loathing. Fearless because after living for two-thirds of a century, I have little to fear other than a long, painful death, being shot full of lead, or a terminal case of disgust. Truth tellers rarely make friends. The messenger risks life and limb, or at least a good tongue lashing, including an invitation to leave this great country. God bless America. The novel, I have a saying that goes something like, "It is not possible to awaken those who only pretend to sleep." This pretty well sums up the vast majority of folks who live in the empire. Fremont, Nebraska, Christmas Eve, 1952. Mother read me the night before Christmas, just before turning off my bedroom light. One of my first memories and the beginning of my search for the truth. Now go to sleep so Santa Claus can come. His elves are watching you. How horrifying. Elves in my bedroom? But aside from the excitement of it all, something was wrong. Even at 4 years old, I was developing some sense of the size, scope, and scheme of things on Earth. I knew there were big cities and lots of countries, thousands, millions of little kids, but the reality was that even our little town of 15,000 or so would be too much for Santa Claus to handle in one night, even a long winter's night. Mother was lying, but why? Lucky for me, Mom and Dad leaned strongly toward atheism, so I wasn't subjected to all the smoke and mirrors of organized religion. And although Dad fought in World War II and was a member of General MacArthur's honor guard in the Pacific, he never ever played the red, white, and blue card, never talked about the period of his life that he wanted most to forget, never joined a VFW post or wore a war celebrating cap, never encouraged me to join the military and make him proud. So as I grew into young manhood and left the mandatory parent to child lives behind, I was in a unique position among my friends. I had no new adult lies to replace the childhood ones. I was free to explore and make up my own mind. This was the greatest gift my parents could have given me and the heaviest burden. So when 1970 arrived, along with my notice of mandatory induction into the U.S. Army, I already decided that the Vietnam War was a misguided and insane party which I would not be attending. Most of my friends bought the snake oil Uncle Sam was peddling and took the ceremonial step forward, joining in the Southeast Asian Holocaust. My plans for the future did not include participation in wars for corporate profit, so I refused induction. The local draft board didn't seem to get the message, and a year later, I was forced to once again give Uncle Sam the middle finger salute. I haven't found any figures on the subject, but I may be the only American to ever refuse induction into the U.S. military twice. I do it again. The original sentence was 9 months at Lompoc Federal Prison, but my lawyer appealed and I got to spend 2 years doing alternative duty in a local hospital. My take on Americans is this. They pretend to sleep. Every time the truth tries to show its ugly head, they close their eyes and begin snoring and drooling. They can even fake rapid eye movement. They have no interest in the truth, for they're perfectly comfortable living their lives. The Tooth Fairy, Easter Bunny, and Santa Claus have been replaced with adult lies. They live in fantasy land, the Matrix, the Twilight Zone, and woe be unto him who points out the man behind the curtain. Their reality is reality television shows, corporate news broadcasts, professional sports. They believe in capitalism with all their hearts, even when they lose their jobs. Their kids are in prison and the banks foreclose on their houses. They believe in American exceptionalism, even when the rest of the world is calling for death to Americans. Americans don't want to know that their founding fathers were slave-owning, wealthy businessmen who only broke away from England in order to set up their own scam based on British-style piracy. Don't attempt to tell them that Thomas Jefferson not only owned slaves, but was top stud on his own slave-breeding farm. Don't tell them that Abe Lincoln had absolutely no interest in freeing the slaves, that the Civil War was fought because of what the South considered unfair tariffs, and that the Emancipation Proclamation was only issued to encourage the slaves to fight for the Union. Don't tell them about the Great American Holocaust and the tens of millions of Native Americans who were unceremoniously slaughtered along with the vast bison herds that sustained them. Americans don't want to know that all the wars in their country's history were fought because of greed, that Hitler would never have become so powerful without U.S. banks financing his war machine, without Ford and other U.S. corporations supplying equipment, and without IBM organizing his work camps, that Roosevelt precipitated the attack on Pearl Harbor and knew it was coming, that Truman dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, fully understanding that Japan wanted desperately to surrender. Don't tell them about the sordid history behind the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Don't tell them that all those millions of innocent rice farmers and thousands of American kids died for Wall Street. Don't even mention that Oswald has nothing to do with John Kennedy's execution, nor that Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr., MLK, Malcolm X, and Paul Wellstone were slaughtered because they refused to cooperate fully with the U.S. war machine. I can hear the snoring already. Americans don't want to know that the official government explanation of the attacks of 9/11 is perhaps the greatest fairy tale since Alice in Wonderland. Don't tell them that Osama bin Laden's death a couple months after 9/11 was widely reported in Pakistan. Don't even whisper that the USA is a fascist empire, even though it's obvious to anyone who's even half awake that corporations own the government on every level, and that fascism, by Mussolini's own definition, is the merger of state and corporate power. Most Americans don't even realize that their country is an empire. Go and figure. I'm getting bored with statistics. How many innocent people are gunned down in the streets of America each year? Too many is the answer. How many has Obama snuffed at weddings, funerals, and on playgrounds with his beloved drone warfare? How many died in Iraq and Afghanistan since the first Bush dropped the first depleted uranium? How many expats from Latin America died in the Southwest deserts trying to avoid being captured and jailed for the supreme crime of trying to support their families? Again, too many. How many black and brown men are living in our prisons, working their lives away in our system of neo-slavery? incarcerated for mostly poverty-related crimes and fattening the bankrolls of American corporations, crimes that would never have been committed in a just economic system. 9 black folks were recently murdered in a South Carolina church, and now a cry goes up from the slumbering masses to remove the Confederate flag from the Capitol grounds. The flag represents a culture of hate, violence, and racism, they say. They are right, but they continue to fly and pledge allegiance to the Stars and Stripes. They stand at attention when the national anthem is played. Tears fill their eyes as the singer glorifies rockets and bombs, the same rockets and bombs the Empire has used since the end of World War II to slaughter 40 or 50 million ordinary people who were just trying to pursue happiness. But I don't really have a body count. The military doesn't count dead enemies, and like I said, I'm bored with statistics anyway. When does murder ascend to mass murder, and how many dead bodies does it take to constitute a genocide, a Holocaust? How about a Holocaust? I suspect that most of the sleeping Americans will sleep through the imminent demise of capitalism and empire. Of course, nobody knows exactly how and when this end will take place, but it will happen one way or another. Nuclear winter, simple collapse of the world economy, global climate disaster. I forgive my mother for the childhood lies. I told the same ones to my daughter. If I had it to do over again, I would have come clean on Santa. No more lies. Hey, how about those Mets?
From D. Trump, near Central Park, we hear this. The poor and the working class in the United States know what it is to be Greek. They know underemployment and unemployment. They know life without a pension. They know existence on a few dollars a day. They know gas and electricity being turned off because of unpaid bills. They know the crippling weight of debt. They know being sick and unable to afford medical care. They know the state seizing their meager assets, a process known in the United States as civil asset forfeiture, which is permitted American police agencies to confiscate more than $3 billion in cash and property. They know the profound despair and abandonment that come when schools, libraries, neighborhood health clinics, daycare services, roads, bridges, public buildings, and assistance programs are neglected or closed. They know the financial elite's hijacking of democratic institutions to impose widespread misery in the name of austerity. They, like the Greeks, know what it is to be abandoned. The Greeks and the U.S. working poor endure the same deprivations because they're being assaulted by the same system, corporate capitalism. There are no internal constraints on corporate capitalism, and the few external constraints that existed have been removed. Corporate capitalism manipulating the world's most powerful financial institutions, including the Eurogroup, the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and the Federal Reserve, does what it is designed to do. It turns everything, including human beings and the natural world, into commodities to be exploited until exhaustion or collapse. To swell its profits, corporate capitalism plunders, represses, and drives into bankruptcy individuals, cities, states, governments. The Greek government kneels before the bankers of Europe, begging for mercy because it knows that if it leaves the Eurozone, the international banking system will do to Greece what it did to the socialist government of Salvador Allende in 1973 in Chile. It will, as Richard Nixon promised to do in Chile, make the economy scream. The bankers will destroy Greece. If this means that the Greeks can no longer get medicine, well, Greece owes European drug makers €1 billion, well, so be it. This means food shortages. Greece imports thousands of tons of food from Europe a year. So be it. This means oil and gas shortages. Greece imports 99% of its oil and gas. So be it. Bankers will carry out economic warfare until the current Greek government is ousted and corporate political puppets are back in control. Human life is of no concern to corporate capitalists. The suffering of the Greeks, like the suffering of ordinary Americans, is very good for the profit margins of financial institutions such as Goldman Sachs. The system of unfettered capitalism is designed to callously extract money from the most vulnerable and funnel it upward to the elites. Wait until the financial house of cards collapses again and Wall Street runs for cover. Then America will become Greece on steroids. The corporate dismantling of civil society is nearly complete in Greece. It's far advanced in the United States. We, like the Greeks, are undergoing a political war waged by the world's oligarchs. No one elected them. They ignore public opinion, and as in Greece, if a government defies the international banking community, it's targeted for execution. The banks do not play by the rules of democracy. Our politicians are corporate employees, and if you get dewy-eyed about the possibility of the U.S. having its first woman president, well, remember that it was Hillary Clinton's husband who decimated manufacturing jobs with the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement and then went on to destroy welfare with the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, which halted federal cash aid programs and imposed time-limited restrictive state block grants. Under President Bill Clinton, most welfare recipients, and 70% of those recipients were children, were dropped from the rolls.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Some notes we have been receiving during the first half of our show from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telepathy, and telegraph.
Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown, at the end of the umpire. Time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook. The bread and butter of 3B1K Publishing House, managed by Nick Estatic Screenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody's paying much attention to history these days. What's he to do? Well, he's running all over town to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing, and today he talks to his employees in the auditorium. Nick stood at the podium on the stage in the company auditorium where Willie Nelson had just played the day before as part of the ongoing lunchtime cultural awareness program put on by HRPR. The seats were not nearly full because it was early, but he did not want to wander near his own office with Fulton Crampton and Harlan Lombardi on double secret stakeout. Hello? Hello, is this on? Nick came from behind the podium. He's here, he heard someone exclaim. Nick sat on the edge of the stage. He began to talk. We can't hear you. He fell to his back, rolled over, got to his hands and knees, and crawled up by the podium. We can't see you. Someone brought up a stool. He stood on the stool. Can any of you mother schmuckers hear me now? He whispered to himself, but it went out quite clearly. Tapped the microphone. Oh, yes. Perfectly. Better than last year? Yes, I believe so. They stood and clapped, gave Nick a standing ovation. Nick put his mouth right over the microphone like a heavy metal singer. Anyone who doesn't sit the schmuck right down now, I'm going to come out personally and pound. I don't care if you're a woman or elderly, what the hell you are. He said it like a rock star with his mouth all over the microphone like a baby with a rattle, and it worked. So they could not really hear him, only just get the gist. They smiled, some clapped, some nodded, waved hello to those around them as they sat. Signs had been set up around him in a semicircle on easels from the art department. Seek not to arouse parents. Who controls the present, controls the past. The history book must inspire children with patriotism, must be careful to tell the truth. Optimistically, must dwell on failure only for its value as a moral lesson. Texas requires a textbook should not contain material which serves to undermine authority. the history of the United States shall be taught as genuine history and shall not follow the revisionist or postmodernist viewpoints of relative truth. American history shall be viewed as factual, not as constructed. The memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away, and for such people with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. Don't want a book with an axe to grind. So what are we going to do now? He spread his arms wide as a famous preacher might have. They did not understand him. They looked at each other, leaned forward in their seats. They must give him the answer he wants, but as with Stalin, there were so many ways to displease him that perhaps the best one could do was shoot oneself. He hopped down from the stool. He walked around the stage, gesturing, shouting. He sat again on the stage with his feet dangling, talking softly, pleading. The department heads, Michelle Jones, editing, Lori Groom, art, research and writing, Buddy Fowler, maintenance and landscaping, Cade Ewart, crowd control and security, Catherine Bambi Cartwright, HR PR, sat on the extreme very edge of their seats, following his every move, wanting to give the immediate perfect response. Austin Belloncioni, lead accountant, sat on an aisle step, hunched over a yellow legal pad, occasionally punching in an adding machine he'd brought from his office. Assistant executive assistant Daisy Dornor paced the hallways, keeping an eye on Fulton Crampton and Harlan Lombardi, relaying up-to-the-minute reports to executive assistant Joan McCarthy, standing in the hall doorway, hands across her chest, watching Nick Green on stage. Nick asked someone to bring up a copy of this year's book. He sat on the front of the stage, paging through. I've not actually looked at one of these things for years. He looked up and smiled, a tear on his cheek. That was my sophomore year, he said. Supposed to be my sophomore year. I dropped out to work here. He laid the book on the wood next to him. You know, there's actually a backpack law. Several of the department heads wagged their heads up, down, enough for Nick to be able to see them nodding. They can't be this big, not really. Hurts the kids' backs just to carry them. Is it worth it? What we put in there for the kids, is it worth it for them to break their backs? Lies my teacher told me, he said. That's a real book. Just get through it. That's what some teachers hope for with our history book. Anybody read Harry Potter? You want to just get through it? Or did you enjoy it? Nick talked about drama versus melodrama, the eternally optimistic approach to history, and how old editions are usually the same as the new editions. Best thing we have to offer kids is the subtitle, he said. And they suck. You know they do. Big time. They're so stupid. He held up his hand and smiled. Hey, you know I love you guys. I appreciate the work you've done. Thank you so much for coming out today. Listen to an old man. Go back to your comfort zones. Put in some real book publishing work in your nice little offices. Get me some new ideas, or every schmuckin' one of you is fired. Have a nice schmuckin' day. If any one of you clapped, you're fired right smucking now. Nick walked out of the auditorium, straight to the boiler room where the generals waited. Nick sat on the bar stool at the corner, facing the generals on the old sofa and chairs. For an hour and a half, they drank coffee and smoked and spit and talked about Martians and the War of the Worlds. That's the news from Newtown. For all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that brings us near the end of another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. And we thank you for being with us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week. And we hope you'll visit newdream.us to listen to our archive shows. I'd like to thank our wonderful guest tonight. And I'd especially like to thank my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek. Good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Thanks. Yes, thanks to our guests, M.K. Davis, Anthony Rayson, and Larry Pinkney. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to the show.newamericandream.info. And I just said that wrong. It's some other thing that Chuck said, so go back and listen to that. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota's stone artist Borglum Borgumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at loserock.com, rollingstones.com, and Jack Ruby, RubyRich.com. To help support the show, please purchase one of our Tom Jefferson Rolling in His Grave Handy Campfire Rotisseries for the hobo in your family, or get one of our family-sized Obamaville Tom Jefferson Rotisseries for the busy family on the move from woods to woods, town to town, made in Korea. And so, good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Saloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Reverend Pinkney. Good night, Mohammed Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Imagine there's no heaven, it's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Imagine no